Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Cormac O'Hara. The Dáil return this week, but politicians have been pinned to the wall by the Young already. What is their response to climate change protests? We'll discuss that and the Uachtaráin direct provision controversy and more in a moment. But first, the news read by Susan Jackson. Gormila Mogget, Susan Jackson, and you're welcome to the programme. The first of the new season, 51551, if you want to contact the politicians or the panel. You can email saturday@rte.ie. You can even WhatsApp us this season, 087-187-9101, if you want to WhatsApp any of the panel. And they are Niamh Smith. She's a Fianna Fáil spokesperson on arts, culture and heritage and TD for Cavan Monaghan. Martin Kenny is Sinn Féin spokesperson on justice and equality and TD for Sligo Leitrim. James Riley had difficulty finding the studio, difficulty finding your way in. Why is that, James?
Because I haven't been here in a year and you closed the old gates.
And I wonder why he's here. There must be a by-election in the air. Who knows?
James Riley. Just never got an invitation. Shockingly.
I doubt that. Fine Gael senator and former minister for health. You heard him. Larissa Nolan is a journalist and newspaper columnist, and Ola Magicadumi is a journalist and broadcaster on Radio Na Laoise. Now, thousands of you around the country in Dublin, 10,000 of you, mostly young people, took to the streets yesterday protesting, demanding action from government on climate change as the Minister for Finance and the government plans for its budget in weeks' time. Can I ask a politician? Let's start with you, James Riley, since you're here on behalf of the government. Are you embarrassed to be spanked publicly by young children and young people on inaction in terms of climate change like that yesterday?
On the contrary, I'm delighted to see that young people are getting involved, that they're aware, that they're protesting, that they're concerned about their future. I was at a Young Fine Gael meeting actually earlier in the week, and I was a bit surprised to hear from a couple of the younger members that they were being dissuaded by their teachers from going out to express their opinion. I think it's a very positive development. But I fully accept, having said all that, that we're laggards, as the Taoiseach acknowledged, on climate change. But we have now in Richard Bruton a new minister who's going to put in place the Climate Action Plan.
So no embarrassment at all. You've been in power for the last 8 years, that youngsters in this country feel the need to go out, and I use that word, spank you publicly as politicians and leaders because of inaction. Surely that's shameful, given the crisis.
It is not satisfactory, but in this country in particular, we have come through a major recession. Many of the things that we could have done, should have done, couldn't be done because the money wasn't there to do it. But there is a very good plan. No, and I mean, don't forget that this was a strike action all over the world. It wasn't just focused on this country. But I mean, we do have a good plan in place, and nobody better than Richard Bruton to make sure that it's enacted. He has put in 180 actions with subsections behind each to ensure that they're achieved so that we can encourage more people to retrofit their homes, that we can get more electric cars on the road, that we encourage and use. There will be a carbon tax, and that money should be ring-fenced to help people retrofit.
And 51551, before I bring in Martin Kenny, what about Fianna Fáil, if we're supporting James Riley's party, Fine Gael in power? Is the plan that he mentions good enough to satisfy the people who took to the streets yesterday?
Well, firstly, we don't support Fine Gael. We are facilitating a government, Cormac, and we've said that on numerous occasions. I think that we've had to do the honourable thing in the sense that we don't want to see the chaos that has ensued in Westminster, and that's the reason we are doing a confidence of supply.
We don't support
the government. However, it was very welcome to see all the students out. It is one of those things where we see young people actually taking the lead on this, and you're right, they were out protesting the government's inaction on climate change, and we as a party, and Timmy Dooley, my own spokesperson on climate action, have put forward many measures in terms of we've seen a beef crisis, and I've seen that firsthand across Cavan Monaghan at the protests at the meat factories, and it's all about what our plans are for going forward. And
is their plan good enough?
No, we want to see more done. We want to see.
Is the crisis deep enough then? Is the climate change crisis deep enough? if the Fine Gael plan isn't good enough for you to pull the plug on the government and say, look, we need a better plan, this is too urgent?
I can assure you, Cormac, only that we have what we have in hand, and that's with Brexit. I don't believe this government would be still in place, and that's been honest.
Brexit is a bigger crisis, a bigger priority than climate change for Fianna Fáil.
No, but it's the most immediate that we've got to deal with. I'm not saying that for one second. In terms of climate action, we have asked in numerous occasions that plans be put in place that would actually encourage biodiversity, would encourage diversity within farming, that would encourage native deciduous planting of our landscapes and our trees and in the
51551. Fianna Fáil is saying, let's deal with Brexit first and then we'll get to climate change.
Yeah, no, what I actually said was, we have Brexit in less than 40 days, right? And alongside all of that, we'll have a budget and we'll be watching to see and ensure that there's actually actions put in place. Unlike the last time when the government announced a budget, there was any measurable, tangible measures that people could actually say they were attacking climate action.
Martin just Kenny
to,
of Sinn Féin.
Yeah, no, just to say that, first of all, to commend the young people that went out and protested, and, you know, what they're really asking for is that there has to be a change of behaviour, and that, you know, everyone has a personal responsibility in that behavioural change. But the big change that needs to be made is how we produce our energy. You know, if everyone in the country changes to, you know, stop using disposable cups and take care of their plastic, it won't have the effect that we need to be having for to make a real impact on climate change. Really what we need to be looking at is how we produce our energy and the mechanisms we have of doing that. And we're still burning coal in Money Point. You know, that's the kind of stuff that we actually...
Should stop that in power?
Absolutely. We need to... Money Point was closed down for a number of months this year and it didn't happen.
My question is wider in terms of fossil fuels.
Yes, we would.
You'd ban all the use of fossil fuels in state agencies.
What we need to do is we need to phase out fossil fuels immediately, and we need to start finding alternatives. And one of those alternatives is, for instance, biomass, which is an opportunity for the farming community to have a role in and to do something about there. We also need to be looking at more solar panels. Every farmhouse in the country should have a solar panel on the roof with all their sheds.
And we should protect our natural resources in terms of water charges, maybe?
We should protect our natural resources in a way that doesn't in any way mean that ordinary people out there are the ones that are forced to pay for this, because every crisis we have in our economy, and not just in this economy, but every economy around the world, the ordinary poor people are the ones that's forced to pay, while those at the very top continue to get away, and that's what has continued to happen.
Ola, you were on the streets yesterday working as a journalist. What was the feel of it?
It was very clear that these young people were dissatisfied with the government, how they're planning action on these issues. And it was a very energetic crowd, and it's different from anything I've ever seen, because it was mostly young people and students protesting, and they took their time to get on the streets at Custom House to do this, to protest. And it's just very commendable.
Yeah, that's what all the politicians are saying. I wonder what the reaction will be from young people, Larissa, when they hear all of the politicians, to a man and woman, say, fair play to the young people. Yeah. Sounds a bit patronising to me, if you don't mind me saying so.
It does sound patronising, but everybody is afraid to say anything else other than that. I mean, even there just a minute ago, Cormac, when Niamh said, you know, that maybe we should prioritise Brexit, it was deemed to be an outrageous thing to say. But if you look at, sociologists will always tell you that the only thing as important as protecting the earth is, you know, protecting the people on the earth. And so we do have there are all these other issues that are just as important, and I don't think it should be a hierarchy of, you know, what's more important. To kind of, you're leading into sort of virtuous shows there as opposed to actual action. I think, yes, it's always great when young people are, you know, are politicised and show political action.
Hang on a second, because that was the message from the streets yesterday. I'm just relaying the message. They say it was more important to be on the streets and demanding action yesterday than work or school.
Right, well, it's very easy, though, isn't it, for you to say, look, this is a day off school and we get to march out for the day and we get to show our support, and that's great. But what I would hate for young people themselves is if they end up going, you know, that's my day out for the day and that's what I've done as my part of activism. Activism is about a lot more than that. And, you know, even as a young person, I was out from everything from anti-extradition to anti-vivisection personally. You know, in my own family, it was very much encouraged.
Are you that cynical about the protest yesterday, then?
No, I believe that it shouldn't be. Young people shouldn't be told that this is enough to do this. It's enough to get out and lecture. On occasion, the narrative has been older people are terrible. Like, there's pictures in the paper today going, you know, the dinosaurs thought the earth would go on and so are you, kind of thing. I found that older people should be looked towards. I mean, older people didn't have iPhones. They didn't. They walked to school. They were naturally economical. It should be a more inclusive, the narrative that's going down of, you know, old people, oh, they haven't a clue and they don't care about us. There's only one thing that parents care about, and that's their children's future. And that it should be a unifying message and not a divisive message of us against them, good against evil. You know, a lot of the time, as Martin pointed out, there is a class element to this in relation to what people can afford and what people can't afford. Mm. I've engaged in very pro-environmental behaviour myself. I mightn't have the money instantly to put solar panels up in my house, but it doesn't mean that I'm any less engaged than anybody else. And I would hope that the students know that, because there's a hubristic element to not realising that, and humility makes good political leaders.
What about higher carbon taxes in the budget forthcoming, James Reilly?
Well, I mean, we have to make our target of 80 euros per tonne in the next 10 years. So obviously we need to show a sign that we're serious about that by increasing taxes. The government haven't determined on a figure yet, but a lot of people are talking about 6 euro a tonne per annum, which gives a very clear indication that it's going to go up by 6 euros every year to reach the 80 in the 10-year period ahead. And then the question is, whether should it be... Well, I think you have to consider, if you go quicker, then you're going to affect some industries that are heavily dependent upon it, like haulage and others. And if you go about it in an incremental way that shows you're serious, that you're going to reach your target, then I think you'll get greater buy-in and less unforeseen consequence. I also believe that the money should be ring-fenced, and this is my own personal view, that far... environmental initiatives around retrofitting homes, around creating cycle pathways and walkways, around more public transport, and around protecting those who are poorer and who will suffer fuel poverty as a consequence.
That's your personal view, that it should be ring-fenced. But you have a credibility problem in government, don't you? Because Maria Murnane says, do you really believe that the carbon tax will be ring-fenced to deal with climate change? I do not. Now, you come with a personal view, saying that it should be ring-fenced. You don't come with a governmental view.
No, well, it's not my place to give...
You're here on behalf of the government.
Hold on one sec now, Carl. Let me finish what I'm saying. It's not my place to say what Pascal Donoghue's going to do. But what I can say to you is that the view I'm reflecting was the majority view expressed down at the meeting in Cork.
But surely the government should have...
Which I travel to in my electric car without stopping.
Well, fair play to you. Surely the government should have a stated position in terms of ring-fencing carbon taxes at this stage. Surely the government should have a stated position in terms of reducing the dairy herd number. It's rising instead of decreasing.
Well, let's deal with the first point first. And I would remember this only too well from my time as minister. I felt very, very clearly and strongly... And I made a proposal with Phil Hogan at the time that there should be a litter tax on cigarette packets, and that that money should be split between environment and health so that we could address the issues around health and well-being and smoking and tobacco in particular. But we had no hope at it, and I was not dropping names because both the Taoiseach and Richard Bruton are over in UN at the moment in New York, but I was over there, and this was a common theme amongst all the ministers I was talking to at the time in the UN, that governments are very strongly against what they call hypothecated taxes, i.e. ring-fenced taxes for a particular purpose, yet we do have precedents for it. So,
is this not different though, I wonder?
This is really serious, and I think that the money collected, people have to see that the money that they're paying in a carbon tax or a green tax, whatever you want to call it, is going to be used to progress the agenda of protecting our environment.
Well, I think you put your finger on it, James Reilly, because I think, based on talking to various people who were protesting yesterday and so on, that they simply don't trust politicians enough. If politicians come to them and say, give me more taxes and I promise you action on climate change or public services, they recoil, they resile and say, I don't trust that crowd to do it.
Well, let's see what the budget shows, and let's see what...
We've had carbon tax now, and it's not ring-fenced. We've had carbon tax for years, and it isn't ring-fenced.
No, well,
you know,
it should be.
So it should be, but I mean, who's in government, James? You know, that's...
Yeah, well, I mean, we're not alone in government, number one, and weren't alone in government in the last government.
Both Fianna Fáil, Niamh Smith, you're up here. A text from a listener. Both Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are disgraced in relation to climate change. Their agricultural, transport and housing policies all undermine any efforts to address climate change. As young people get the vote, these parties will go extinct.
Well, I mean, I just don't agree with that. I know from our parliamentary party meetings, from our front bench meetings, there is a genuine concern and interest in progressing climate action. And it's not just talk. We have met with all the interested parties, Birdwatch Ireland, Heritage Council. I mean, there's more than just, I suppose, one element to it. There's so many elements, and I take the point that Martin's making. It's not, what we do individually might be small. However, if we all play our part in that, it has to make a big difference. And like Larissa said too, I mean, it is wonderful to see the young people doing it, and there is I suppose, a generation of young people that are coming through schools that have had their green flags in their schools, both primary, secondary, and they're going to be a far more conscientious generation probably than we were. But also the point that you've made, the older generation, well, they didn't have half the waste that we see consume and compile
in
our
homes.
Talking
about individual obligation is frittering around the edges. It's politicians and parties like yourselves and Fine Gael and Sinn Féin not committing to tackling big industry. I mean, let me give you an example. In terms of the pharmaceutical sector in Ireland, that accounts, according to the CSO, for 44% of economic trade here. The Journal of Cleaner Production, published in March of this year, said, surprisingly, our analysis reveals that the pharmaceutical industry is significantly more emission intensive than the automotive industry, the car industry. So we have a huge amount of pharmaceuticals, multinationals in this country. Are they audited in terms of the green agenda?
Probably not, Cormac, and I can't pretend to know something I don't. But, I mean, as a party, we are in favour of a carbon tax and an increase to it. And we thought we would see that in the last budget, and we didn't. And we're acknowledging the fact that that is a route we have to go, albeit ensuring that people don't fall into more, I suppose, fuel poverty. We don't want to see that happening, or we don't want to see it be affecting the most vulnerable in society either. I mean, the government launched their electric cars and electric public vehicles with huge fanfare, but we have insisted that, you know, all public transport fleet for Dublin would be electrified and not the diesel guzzlers are.
The point that people miss here is that if you electrify all the cars and you electrify all the public transport, we have a problem with our energy supply to be able to deal with that. You know, we have to get back to
the grid. Has to be upgraded.
The grid has to be upgraded. We have a whole range of things that we need to do. And the big thing we need to do is there's no point in having everybody driving electric cars and using coal to produce the electricity. And that's what we're doing right now. We need to go back to where the beginning is. And the beginning is how we produce energy in this country. And how we produce energy in this country is a very dirty way of doing it. Now, we have some use of gas, which is slightly cleaner, and some people say it's a transition. But really, we need to get back to basics and realise that we have a big task here. And putting all the emphasis, while, yes, we all have individual responsibility, but putting all the emphasis on the individual for the change will not make the big difference. And the carbon tax, ultimately, is what that's about. The individual would be taxed, and that will force them to change. And we know from experience.
Sorry, the individual won't be taxed, but the products will be taxed that are high on fossil fuels. So fossil fuels themselves, they'll pay more for petrol and diesel unless you've got a hybrid or an electric car. The same will go for your house if you don't retrofit it. The same will go for your heating. And that's why there are grants available, and we want to increase the grants for deep retrofits to encourage people to keep going with that.
So people in rental property,
individual decisions can make a huge difference. Last point, if you put up solar panels on your, and I know they're expensive, but there are government grants to do that now. So the big thing here that could reduce the cost of that for people is not having to get batteries as well, so they're not giving electricity free to the grid when Richard Bruton brings in a feed-in tariff so that you get paid for the electricity you produce.
So how do you tackle industry? How do you tackle the big corpus, the pharmaceuticals, for example? Would you be in favour, James Riley, to attach a green condition to foreign direct investment in this?
I certainly think it's something well worth exploring, and I would be in favour of it. And I'd also be in favour of bringing in a series of measures to divert people involved in heavy industry. And the pharmaceutical industry is hugely important to this country and provides many, many thousands of jobs and hundreds of thousands of jobs springing off that. That they, like everything else, you cannot do it overnight. It has to be done in a measured way that doesn't damage the industry irreversibly, but at the same time encourages it to move over to green energy.
It's that kind of delays attitude that, I know, but you see, that leaves us 29 out of 30 or 28 out of 29 in terms of the Climate Action Network Europe report. They said we're the second worst in Europe last year in terms of fighting climate change. And it's that attitude that leaves us there, surely.
I don't think it's that attitude. I think we can't forget where we came from. I mean, from 2011 on, from 2010 on, we were in the hands of the Troika. We were in deep recession. Our capacity to do the things that we wanted to do was severely limited. Now we have no excuse, and now we must act. And that is why I believe there has to be action taken in the budget.
Dear James Riley, says a listener, 51551, I too would like an electric car, but instead I drive a 03 petrol car. This is because you are rich, says the texter, and I am poor, yet you will probably penalise me further in the budget.
No, and I mean, yes, I was rich, but I'm in different circumstances now after 10 years in politics, I can tell you. But the situation for people is that they have to be helped and encouraged towards that. And schemes can be brought in to help people like that person who can't afford a new car. And if they are changing a car, that some sort of subsidies are put in place to help them. And electric cars will get cheaper. It's like everything else. When the first flat TV came out, it was an astonishing price. Now you can buy them very reasonable second-hand. And the same will happen with
okay,
electric
cars. Is there any help for a listener like this, Niamh Smith, in the budget in a few weeks' time? People who are on their knees, effectively, people who can't afford rent, can't get a house in any way, struggling to meet bills. This is a wider discussion now. People who feel, yeah, there's record employment in this country, but why am I feeling the joys of it?
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see the housing crisis, you know, trundle on many years later and no vast improvement on that. And we see that in our clinics every day where we have young people coming in. I mean, I think really and truly the government has failed in terms of pushing our local authorities back into building houses. I remember 20 years ago, Cavan County Council launched a housing scheme of 70 houses. Now we see launches of schemes of 8 houses and 10 houses. I mean, it's not really worth the launch in terms of where the need and what the need is at for people on the ground. We have significant housing waiting lists, and I know Cavan Mon has nothing close to what Dublin or Meath or any of the more urban centred areas are, but there are areas we need to see vast improvement on in this budget. Obviously we're not in government and we
won't be a giveaway budget, says the government.
It won't be, it can't be, it can't. But that's not a budgetary issue. I mean, the insurance problem that we've seen across the country here, that's not a budgetary issue. The housing issue that we've seen across this country is not, it's a partly budgetary thing, but it comes from, driven from the minister's office and the government's office, and I really still can't get my head around.
How do you help poor people like that listener there?
Well, that's what we have to make sure, that any measures that come in, whether it be affect climate or housing, doesn't actually, I suppose, put the more vulnerable people further into deprivation or poverty either. We have to ensure that that happens. But I mean, the big issues still have to be dealt with, whether it be the housing crisis, the health crisis. You know, James Riley has said here on a number of occasions they're in a much better financial position, and I appreciate that we have to deliver, they have to deliver a budget that is Brexit proof, I suppose, if there's such a thing, if perhaps
possible. They feel under pressure from Fianna Fáil, who announced €5 increases here, there and everywhere in terms of social welfare and so on, instead of something that's more targeted. I mean, let me address that question to Ola and Larissa. What do you think would really benefit Ola, people from your generation, as we approach the budget, that would really, really help? Because you don't have to be income poor in this country to be struggling.
Yeah, I wanted to come into that earlier. What I will say is that, from my impressions, young Irish people are not happy with the government, and we're not going to wait anymore for the government to take action, especially from being at the protests yesterday. You know, young people took this ownership to go out and protest. We can't wait until it's too late. Whether that's climate change, whether that's the housing crisis, health crisis, young people are leaving Ireland now. You know, it's starting again. People are emigrating. So we really need to take action fast before it's too late.
The government say, Larissa, that they're reducing housing waiting lists and so on, that they're going as fast as they can.
Yeah, well, there's reports in the paper today that suggest absolutely otherwise. Eoin O'Brien is in the papers today with very good statistics, and he literally wrote the book on why public housing is the answer, so I think he'd certainly know a thing or two about it. The thing is as well, is, I mean, even in relation to this government, I'm glad to hear that young people have finally turned on them, and it seems to have happened very fast, because I'll tell you something, a couple of years ago, in the last recent years, the bread and circuses that Fine Gael in particular have been engaging in relation to kind of, you know, this sort of this image of being so liberal and so progressive, and everybody having epiphanies on all these issues, from everything from abortion to gay marriage, and then suddenly, you know, we're talking where young people are saying, hey, Simon Harris, marry me, and Leo, I think you're great. So I'm glad to hear that finally they've seen through what has been just a shimmer on the surface, while underneath they have been engineering and maintaining a housing crisis. The reason they haven't fixed the housing crisis is because it's a political position.
How so?
They are anti-social housing. It's it's a political ideology that they have engaged in. The facts are all there.
Shane Shiley's sitting on his hands here.
He can sit on his hands, but I'm going to finish saying this. I'm going to finish saying this because it's very important. Their policy is anti-family, and it's very obvious. I mean, if you look anywhere, say, for example, I live in the Liberties in Dublin 8, that's just one place in that I could choose. Every single building around has been made into an apart hotel, or it has been made into one of the co-living is one of the ones that's
coming
up. Student accommodation. 4,000 student accommodation. It's like a city with no children in it. It's absolutely appalling. There's families on their knees, nowhere to live. The social fabric has been destroyed. And Fine Gael have sat there and created a Frankenstein monster of 10,000 mostly women and children in emergency accommodation. And that is appalling, and that is deliberate, and it could be easily solved.
You need to reply.
But it's not.
Get off your phone and reply to that, James Riley, quickly.
I was just looking for a picture. I took the things that we have been doing for families. But to come back to the basic point about housing, there were 18 houses, new houses built last year. There's 20,000 to 25,000 planned for this year, and certainly 50,000 within the next 2 years. There is always a lead-in time. And, you know, even in Fine Gael, in my own area, there's 1,000 new houses planned for Donabate, 1,000 for Balbriggan, and 200 to 300 for Skerries. So, and they are a mix of affordable, social and private housing.
But they're not affordable, James.
But they're developed.
But they're not affordable.
This development is led by government and Fine Gael Council, not by developers, which was the criticism in the past when Fianna Fáil were in power and before we hit the crash.
Larissa calls you anti-family.
No, absolutely anti-family. We're the ones who brought in parental leave. I'm the minister, when I was Minister for Children, who brought in the second year of the ECHE programme, the Early Childhood Care
Education.
Childcare has rocketed. They're good on childcare. I actually think
the government are quite good on childcare. That two-year preschool system is actually excellent and comes in at just the right time. But they have failed families. And, you know, James, like, I speak to people all the time. I work in my area, you know, in activism in relation to helping people stuck in the housing crisis. And it is actually tragic. It is really, really upsetting to hear people's distressing stories, people living in box rooms with their children for 6-7 years in a row, no way of getting out. And the worst of it is, they're the really hard workers. They're the people who really are determined, yep, and they keep on going and they'll never stop. But they're living in these absolutely appalling conditions. And I cannot believe that Fine Gael are just sitting there not doing anything about it year after year as the numbers rise. And actually, James, I would imagine that it's something that you feel that has to be the top priority of the government.
Well, it is, and that's why Owen Murphy is doing as much as he's doing.
He's the worst housing minister ever.
No, he gets very bad PR spin, there's no question about that.
Appalling.
But in the terms of the numbers, the planning permissions coming through.
But they're not for family houses.
Hold on a minute. No. They are family houses. This is Fine Gael, and I know Fine Gael. So look, please don't correct me on my own backyard where
I know what's going on.
I just want to tell you one last thing. In Clongriffin, there's private development going in of 1900s.
Right, we'll all move to Fine Gael, so.
David in Dublin 2 says Cormac cutting down trees, the lungs of the city, to make way for diesel buses, huge emissions, and signing off on oil exploration is insane in the present situation. Please question Richard Bruton's sanity with your panel. Well, I won't question Richard Bruton's sanity, but your question is put to the panel and the wider public. 51551, we'll be back with Uachtaráin Roard after the break.
Email saturday at rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
August Brigade Fáil to Lash, and with Niamh Smith of Fianna Fáil, Martin Kenny of Sinn Féin, James Riley of Fine Gael, Larissa Nolan, journalist, and Ola Magicadumi, journalist as well. You're belting away on the message machine. An awful lot of text. 51551. What is the point of electric cars if they're powered by fossil fuel generated electricity? We don't control that, says a texter. Many, many more.
Let's talk about of our climate change action, that 70% of our energy will come from renewable.
Okay, you're up next as well, James Riley, on Uachtaráin Roard, because there's still around the clock watch by locals there at the hotel site, where it's believed that the state wants to set up a direct provision centre. An awful lot of talk during the week about the process being unfair on the community, that more should be said, confusion about is there a direct provision site going in there or not. My question to you is, why are you persisting with direct provision as is when it's your position to move away from it, I thought?
Well, look, to begin, you know, many of the people who are coming to these centres, they're either already declared refugees, as assessed by the UNHCR, and they're fleeing countries of strife. Others are asylum seekers who are applying for refugee status, and they take longer to assess. And then there are others who arrive who seek protection for humanitarian reasons. The real point here is coming back to your earlier point around why isn't there more consultation, for instance, in a place like Uachtaráid. Until the tender is accepted, until a contract is signed, the department don't get involved because they can't, they
say. But they are involved because they're evaluating an application, aren't they?
Yes, but they won't evaluate it until it's complete. So in other words, I asked David Stanton this morning, the minister, like, who would be doing the work in these places? Is it the department or is it the people who own them? And because I would say, as somebody who's been involved in commercial life, you're going to commit a lot of money to doing a place up if you haven't got a contract. And he said, well, very often they're the people themselves who know what the tender conditions are, and they will improve them.
Roll back a few steps for a second.
So once that happens...
Roll back a few steps. They've been called inhumane, these places. Unfair to people, unfair to families, unfair to children.
Okay, well, let's examine that.
I mean, I thought it was the government's stated position to move away from direct provision as is.
Yes,
is it or is it not?
It is, but to improve what we have as we get there to the situation where we now have, where most people have their own cooking area, which they didn't have before, to having your own door entrance. In the places where they've gone, it's important to note, in the other places around the country where direct provision places, centres are in place, they have worked very well. They have integrated with the community.
Their own cooking area.
Yes, sorry, let's just finish with this. They have groups of friends who communicate. There was a great article this morning on one in Clare where, you know, the locals have become very active, engaged, and both communities are integrating
very
well.
So these centres are okay?
No, they're not.
Well, then why persist with them?
They're far from ideal. But let me tell you this now, and you can do your research on it. They compare very favourably with what's available around Europe. And you're dealing with a situation where we've had an increase of 36% this year of people coming in.
Where in Europe? Hungary?
No, look at Britain. Look at various other places where people have to come in
Britain,
and be...
Where there's a clampdown on immigration.
Yeah, well...
Where the far right wing of the Tory party are in power. I mean, come on, James.
Yeah, well, so look at France and look at Spain, look at Italy.
The land of the Cade Mila Folger are not. I mean,
yes, but
should we be moving away, Niamh Smith, from these type of centres altogether? Or should we just plough ahead and have these discussions?
No. I mean, the figures are that over a third of the asylum seekers in these direct provision centres are children. And I mean, that is shocking. I mean, it's terrible to see people who are coming from war-torn countries tortured, being pitted against local people. And in my mind, it is all about a lack of communication, not engaging with the local community, not explaining to them what's happening, setting fear among the community before there's even a reason for fear. And that's what's happened here. There's been no communication. People feel there's something being thrown at them. They're ill-equipped to deal with it. They haven't got the capacity or the resources in place to deal with it.
How would have done things differently in Uachtaráid?
Well, I would like to think that they would have engaged with the local community, that they would engage with any community or town or city that they're bringing people to. We've seen what happened in Ruiskey.
Before there's a contract signed, is that right?
Yes.
Really? And scare the living daylights out of people, because that's from Kitty Holland's article in the Irish Times. They say, we feel fear, but nothing's been signed.
Well, I mean, this is the lack of communication. We don't... The Department of Justice say nothing has been signed yet. People feel that something is afoot and something is happening. I'll just tell you, Cormac, right? In Ballyjamesduff, which is a part of County Cavan, which is a large Brazilian community living there, OK? They have come there to work because there is a place to work. The schools have had to, I suppose, adapt to be able to have a more, I suppose, to have the places, to have the capacity. Our medical services have had to do that. And I'm not saying in any way it's perfect. They're all creaking at the seams.
So you would welcome
people are
direct
living in the community
centres in your own constituency, I suppose, as well?
I mean, anybody who's come from a war-torn country, who's tortured and all the rest, of course, but it's all about how you do it. It's not about throwing, I suppose, something at people without any engagement, any consideration, and without having the back up of the resources.
So
I think that's the problem in Uachtaráid, where people feel they haven't got the medical resources, they haven't got the education resources, they haven't got the childcare facilities to deal with what may be coming to them.
They say they're fearful in Uachtaráid as well. Is that misplaced, Martin Kinney, that fear?
Well, my experience is it's totally misplaced. For years, we had a small direct provision centre in Ballinamore, a small town in County Leitrim, and none of the people that were ever in that as much as broke a window in the town.
Yeah.
Never mind do anything to... By and large, most of these people that come are coming from countries where they have had huge difficulties, and they want a new start in life. So they're afraid of they're absolutely terrified that they'll be sent home. So they'll do everything to make sure that they get on well with everybody, that they work hard, that they try and get... And one of the good things that has happened recently is that they're now allowed to work. Now, they have to wait 9 months before they can do that. I think that could be short.
No, you're misunderstanding the objections or the fears of the people of Ulster-Ord. As I heard them, they're not really afraid of increased crime rates so much. I heard an awful lot of people say that there's a huge amount of people vis-a-vis the population of the place, and that's a significant change.
Yeah, there are issues about planning and about making sure that you have the correct infrastructure in place to make sure that you have, and in many cases, you know, we know the medical infrastructure, we know the schools and all of that are already stressed and under strain in many of these areas, and there are issues around that. I feel those issues can be dealt with proper consultation, working out with people. Like, I know many people in my local community that worked in the direct provision centre and got employment out of it and were very happy to do so. Mm. So, you know, it's not all a negative. And I think there is another side to this, that we have a kind of an Irish Ku Klux Klan that's going around the country, you know, going out on especially online at this sort of stuff, talking about how...
What do you mean by that?
Well, they're talking about, you know, that, and I've seen them at the Ploughing this week, shouting at politicians, you know, you're going to end up that the Irish are going to be a minority in their own country, and all this kind of absolute total nonsense. And
a texter says 80% of direct provision residents have leave to remain. The issue is housing. There's nowhere for them to go, so they don't leave direct provision. This is a housing, not a direct provision crisis.
Yeah, it's a housing crisis. And as I said in the outset, that, you know, the stuff that they're able to work now is a big help. And hopefully, if they're working, that they'll have a chance for to be able to get on the housing ladder and get out there.
A lot of them don't get the opportunity to work because they don't have the GNIB card. And if you don't have that, a lot of employers won't recognise that. That's so right, it is still a problem. Mm. And just to address your earlier comments, Mr. Riley, about a lot of these centres having cooking places now. That's a basic human right, to be able to cook for yourself. And it's still not implied in a lot of centres. They're still waiting on it. So it's still a huge problem. And I think it's clear that we're going to look back at direct provision in years to come as the Magdalene Laundries, in shame.
So what do you make of this text, Ola? And I'll come to you, Larissa, in just a second. We are not all fearful in Ulster-Ord, says a texter. Many of us will welcome refugees, but current toxic atmosphere in the town makes it impossible to speak out.
Yeah, well, you see, this is kind of coming back to, there's been these divisions in the last couple of years culturally, you know, between, with the rise of identity politics, which is something that I've always been against, because I'm more of the Martin Luther King belief system of unifying people as opposed to dividing them up and segregating them. But what tends to happen is, we know identity politics started with white nationalists. So what tends to happen is when you encourage all this kind of thing, and politically, for political points, you end up, it's, you know, what they call this mutual provocation and reciprocal outrage. And then you get these kind of different sides coming together, and all this sort of stuff rises and boils, and I think that seems to be what's happening here. But for me, more, you know, in recent years in the West, but what seems to me here is that, you know, with direct provision, I think it came in around 99, 2000, around the millennium. I remember being sent over to Mosny at the time to cover it. And, you know, it's. I remember thinking at the time, nothing could be worse than this. It's kind of like a half a life. It's dehumanising. It's not that the people aren't looked after, as in there's a roof over their head and there's food and stuff like that, but it's just the very, very basic half a life. And it also occurred to me that...
But it was supposed to be temporary.
Exactly. And this is the thing, is to be fighting for it now against rural communities, to be fighting and saying, we want to fight to parachute these people in. It's unfair on the people coming in as well into the town, into this place in the middle of nowhere. And then the people in the town are worried about effectively economic reasons as far as they can work out. It's very retrogressive to be still fighting to set up these things. I mean, there's,
for the government to be fighting to set them
for
up,
the government to be fighting. I mean, they should be moving on.
What should they do then?
I don't know what the solution is, but surely there is one at this stage after nearly 20 years of it.
Mm. Well, Fianna Fáil has a solution, I'm sure.
Well, I mean, I think integration is the key thing, and as your texter said there, housing is really the crisis here. Mm-hmm. We need to have houses, places and communities, and I think if people were, rather than just shoving them all into one centre, I think that's the problem. And also what Larissa said there, it's about people have no problem, I think, when people come into an area like that, or no problem coming themselves, once they know it's not long term and they're not going to be there indefinitely.
But it's kind of depressing to see people having to live like this. As I'm saying, they're living this half a life. Like, well,
what about the concerns people have? This texter says the largest countries of origin for asylum seekers this year are Albania and Georgia. What war or persecution is happening in Albania? Joe in Wexford says it goes to the point that some people say these are economic migrants.
Mm-hmm. And that's the comment that Noel Grealish made recently about genuine refugees being from Syria and economic migrants being from Africa. who came here to sponge off the system,
he says.
Yeah, I find those comments very hurtful as someone whose parents came here as asylum seekers, and that is just based on his comments and scaremongering. And it's just very sad to see the direction Ireland might go to a far right, you know, with comments from...
Some people, I won't say an awful lot or all because I don't know, but some people in Uxbridge, for example, gave him an awful lot of support there in terms of those comments. So what should be done when a comment like that is made, James Reilly, I wonder?
Well, I'd prefer if Noel, and I know Noel well, withdrew that because I agree with Ola. I don't think that is remotely appropriate. I just wanted to correct something that Martin said, and I'm not trying to score points, but it's just that a refugee has the same rights as an Irish citizen insofar as they don't need a work permit, they don't need to apply for one, they can work straight away. But I accept that in some of the locations it's very hard to get a job. Secondly, the asylum seeker seeker has to go through a process in relation to whether their refugee status is granted or not. And what happened in the past, and this changed in the law which you alluded to in 2015, was that having gone through the process of applying for a refugee, they could go through the local court, the higher courts, and all the way up, and that could take a number of years. Then they could start again as asylum seekers and take the same route again, and then they could go back and start again on a humanitarian basis, and the whole thing could take 8-9 years. So the legal system was contributing to this, and the law changed that.
Answer quickly before I move on this texter who says... communities are entitled to be angry and not being consulted. When large numbers of people are planted in rural communities with limited services, why are refugees not placed in Dublin near services where they can be assimilated?
Well, they are, and we're looking at places in Dublin. And I mean, you know, I live up the road from Balbriggan now in Nall, and you know, we had an awful lot of people came from Mosny and settled in Balbriggan.
And they have a right to be angry, though, and not be consulted.
They will be consulted, and the point is, it's what do you do first? Do you consult with the people before there's a contract and a definite decision made, or do you consult when a definite decision has been made?
On the Gaeltacht 2 days ago that the process is unfair on the community.
Well, I believe that once a decision is made, then consultation takes place, especially around the issue of medical service, around schools, around transport. All those issues have to be addressed. Listen, what I would ask people in Uachtaráin to do, and I don't mean to butt in on their business, but I would say, look around the country where other direct provision units are, where hubs are, and see how the people are getting
why
on.
Okay
and I think
for,
you'll be greatly
okay
reassured
TVs
by
and ministers
that.
To object to, for example, traveller sites being located in their constituencies because it might change the character of the area, but it's not okay for people of a local village to do the same.
Well, I'm not saying it's okay for ministers and TDs to object.
They've done it, though.
But I've never done that. And I mean,
colleagues of yours have done it.
Sorry.
Say la vie. Okay. We have an awful lot to talk about, an awful lot of text in this. The town of Uachtaráin has no issue with asylum seekers. The community are more than happy to welcome a number of families housed in houses within our community, not a 15 to 20% increase in the population with no services to support them, says a concerned resident.
Well, I'd like to reassure that person that there will be proper consultation if a decision is made to place one there around all those issues that have been raised.
Okay, one TD says we're losing our culture because of a large influx of people into our country. We'll discuss that in just a second.
Email saturday@rte.ie. Saturday with Cormac O'Hara on RTE Radio 1.
You're welcome back to the programme. This week we had the launch of the European City of Culture Galway 2020. We had Culture Night last night, attended by thousands of people across the country. We also heard Michael Collins TD say, how are we talking about bringing so many thousands of people maybe into this country when we haven't looked after our own first? We're losing our culture here, he says. Are we losing our culture?
We're not losing our culture if we invite people in. I don't understand that, to be honest. It actually enriches Ireland. You know, immigrants are the ones that are going to do the work that Irish people don't want to do, actually. I was discussing that with a taxi driver on the way here.
That's the economic side of it, James Reilly. What about our culture? Is he right?
No. And there is no danger to our culture. And furthermore, just to emphasise what Ola has said there, you know, a couple of years ago, we were delighted in Balbriggan. The Loreto won several prizes and the top prize in the Young Scientist exhibition. And the two ladies who were at the top were from Poland. Romania, I beg your pardon. The girl who won first prize in biology was from India, and the third prize was won by an Irish girl and a Polish girl with a joint presentation.
You wouldn't be so running for office point, in a by-election soon, would you?
I will be. There's no way about it. But the point I made at the time, and I'd love to make it here, is that I believe that part of what made America great was that rich mix of nations and peoples that came together, and that, you know, transfer of cultures, ideas and energy.
There is something make Ireland though. Great again. James Trump.
Fingal's already great. Seriously, it adds to our community. And I mean, there's no question or doubt the energy that's brought.
One small point. Hold on,
he wants to make Leitrim great again.
No, I don't want to make Leitrim great. It's already great. The one small point, when you reference in America, and the difference in America is that you had this pile of cultures that all came in together and mixed together and created an American culture. Yeah. But you have to recognise that what happened there is the original culture, the Native American one, was wiped out.
Mm. So you're saying, are you agreeing with
the problem? And the problem we have, the issue that I think is, in Ireland, when all of these come in, we already have a base culture. Yeah. We already have an Irish culture that people adopt and embrace and become part of. Mm. And we have people with all kinds of different colour of skin and different backgrounds and different religions, and they all now talk with Irish accents and for whether they're in Galway or they're in Monaghan or wherever, and they are all part of the Irish community.
So are you saying they should assimilate and integrate as opposed to bring their own culture and keep it in a ghetto?
Well, that's what happened in many places in America, where you have little India and you have little Italy and all these things. But it is to an extent. But I think as well, in Ireland we have something that's even better than that. And I think we should...
better? What do we have here?
I think we have a great Irish culture, Irish wit, Irish humour, Irish music, Irish dance, all of those things, so should be enriched by other people coming
from anywhere in the world is your message, but adopt our culture. Is that
No. Come to everywhere in the world and enjoy and enrich and be part of our culture. Okay. Not adopt it. You don't have to adopt it.
But
you
is there a
choice.
Balance to be struck, Neil?
There is, of course, Cormac. But I would have to say I don't believe that our Irish culture or identity is in any way under threat. I mean, across Cavan Monaghan, there's like 5 national Gael schools. There's Colossa, Oriel, the secondary school, and there's many different nationalities attending those Gael schools, which is fantastic. And I think it is a simulation and bringing people together, and that allows everybody to share in the Irish identity and the Irish culture, but also allowing them to, I suppose, show us and teach us something about their own as well. I think Cultural Night last night, it's fantastic, and you see many, many different nationalities taking part in that too. The Ceoltas Éireann, you see it, many different nationalities playing the Irish instruments, speaking the Irish language.
Let me ask you this one. Irish cultural institutions, right? They receive state money. Now, should their remit be to promote Irish culture or promote cultural activities which could be a melting pot of the cultures of the world?
Their remit is to promote Irish culture, but in naturally, you see with river dance and, you know, other, I suppose, examples like that around the country, it does have a broad appeal, and it is. We're naturally going to be influenced by the people we're around, the people that we spend time with, the people that we might play an instrument with, speak a language with. I suppose that's a gradual thing that may happen over years, but I mean, their job at the moment is and should be to promote the Irish language,
the
Irish culture.
What about the poor funding of culture generally in this country? I mean, successive governments now is really low on the agenda. Talk of Lyric FM, for example, in this place, that it could be because of severe cuts and a severe financial position, that could be in danger. I mean, what does that say about the priority of culture in terms of Ireland?
Well, culture should always be a top priority because it does so much more than just promote the culture. It brings people together, it's inclusive, it's harmonious, and it always has a positive impact on people. And it would be terrible to see Lyric FM being in any way under threat. And again, you'd have to say, is that the arts aspect of RTE the first thing that's going to be under threat because there's a deficit? There is an all-party Oireachtas committee that has said that, you know, we're losing out somewhere between 35 and 50 million on TV licences, right? Now, the deficit within RTE is a lot less than that, and there is ways of doing it, and it certainly shouldn't be to cut something like Lyric FM to plug a hole.
Yeah, a texter, Larissa, says, tell the English people of Bradford or Leicester that their culture hasn't changed.
Well, I mean, I think I'd just prefer to focus on Ireland and the fact that if you think that Irish culture is going to be wiped out, well, it goes against all historical pattern, because we've actually brought our culture around the world for this tiny little country. I think we've probably the most influence than any other country.
Centuries of trying to suppress it.
Exactly. Yeah. So we've actually historical background of it not being stamped out. It doesn't. People tend to embrace it and they love it. And, you know, St. Patrick's Day is probably the biggest or second biggest festival in America. So I can't see how it's suddenly going to be wiped out. I think that we do a lot of exchanging of ideas and creativity when we bring, you know, when we exchange, like, for example, because you were talking about the schools there, my son goes to a school where it's 50% people from all other nationalities and 50% inner city. And we exchange ideas and we learn from that about the world. I think it's actually incredible.
Can I ask you all about something Martin Kenny of Sinn Féin says, that people from all around the world come here and enjoy Irish culture but have the space to enjoy their own culture as well. You say you have African heritage and culture in your family. Do you feel you have that space?
Yeah, I mean, I do definitely embrace both. I embrace Irish and Nigerian culture. And I think it's very important as a young Nigerian Irish woman to make sure that, like, those spaces are created. And even recently, you know, I've established, like, an event with my friend Zainab and my cousin Jess, Beyond Representation, which is for women of colour here in Ireland to celebrate our achievements in arts, media and business, because we don't see that representation. And that's a really big problem. And you're saying, like, about integration, but it's important that we actually invite people into our society to feel like they can integrate. Because a lot of the time, people feel like they're in the background.
Yeah.
You know, and I still even feel like that sometimes.
But
even
as you're not in the background, you've got the final word here, because I'm against the clock. I'd say grazie mille, mille buchas lat, agus mwichas lishan banyal, Neil Smith, Martin Kenny of Sinn Féin, James Riley, Fine Gael, Neil Smith, Fianna Fáil, Larissa Nolan, and Ola Magigadumi, Gura Mila Maga Verfad, back with more culture, fun, and frolics. Jehine, Jesarn Jehogan, Jehine Chlug. Until then, arrivederci.
Saturday with Cormac O'Hara was produced by Tom Donnelly. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was David Phelan. And Harry Booklis was on sound.